It's a very great joy to be with you for this auspicious gathering. And I want to especially welcome the retreatants who have recently arrived for this sacred event. And I hope that you allow yourself to receive the full grace of the power of God that is being given to us all at this moment in the final phase of the cycle of time. So, what is this retreat about? Let me see. The mystery of evil and its overcoming. Seems appropriate to cover such a topic beginning here on Good Friday. Happy Good Friday to you all. And of course, it occurs at a moment in the field of current events, soon after a massacre in Moscow, followed by the bumping off of the bridge in Baltimore, and the synchronicity of those events is far from coincidental, as I'm sure you understand. But I am mostly concerned in this retreat with the archetypal information required to get not only to the root, even the seed of the mystery of evil, but to the power of its overcoming. And in order to achieve that, of course, there must be an accurate attitude of humility and surrender, but also of recognition of the divine nature of all of us, of reality, of this cosmic hologram, and the intelligence that is operating, directing, guiding, unfolding all of its theodramatic events toward a final denouement that is now very close. But archetypally, we are, of course, celebrating the Holy Week of Easter. And it may be useful to understand in some way the succession of mythological and spiritual orders that preceded the founding of the Easter holiday, which of course occurs symbolically at least at the time of the spring equinox. And is in a way the beginning of the new springtime. And so it's the coming out of the darkness back into the light. The coming out of the living death that is ego consciousness into resurrection and rebirth as pure spirit. which was, of course, the message of Rav Yeshua in his teaching. But the Easter holiday, the word actually comes directly from an earlier Germanic tradition, and in which the goddess Ilster, which is pronounced very much like Easter, was celebrated. And she's both the goddess of the springtime, the world renewal, and the goddess of the dawn. And very often, the same goddess signifies both powers, because the dawn at a lower fractal level is the beginning of a new cycle of the day and coming after the darkest hour of the night. The springtime comes after the dead of winter with the resurrection of life. And so it is that transformation, both on the physical and on the spiritual plane, at the largest fractal cosmic level, it's at the end of the cycle of time, the kalpa, the end of Kali Yuga, the last quarter of that cycle, where the darkness begins to build until it reaches the end, in which the world is taken over by forces of darkness. But it's in that darkest hour that the light returns. And we are here not only celebrating that return, but ushering it into manifestation, because that is the function of those who are children of God. And so we are here to overcome evil, but we know that the primary evil is not out there, but it only exists out there as long as it exists in here. And so the evil that we must overcome is the evil within. And if we don't focus on that, then we'll make a terrible mistake. Because evil at the level of common egoic discourse is nothing more or less than an ideological foundation for making accusations about others. So, for example, the Palestinians who are now in a battle with what they would call the Zionist terrorist state are fighting against evil. But those who identify as Israelis would say, no, it's Hamas that is evil, and we are fighting for our right to exist. And so evil is used in a partial way, in which the application of evil means is justified by an illusion of goodness. And that illusion is based on a finite kind of love. And so it's very odd, because we say God is love, but God is infinite love, not finite partial love. And the problem with the ego is it loves this group, but it hates every other group. It loves its family, but not others. It loves its partner, but not others. It may not even love its own partner. It may not even love itself, because it's split into a variety of fragments. But its love cannot be for the whole, and it cannot be from that source of consciousness that is the intelligence that underlies and pervades the whole. And so, oddly enough, love is both villain and rescuer and hero in the piece. And the difference resides in the identification of the consciousness that may feel what it calls love, which may in fact only be the desire to possess, to dominate, to have control, status, prestige, many motivations can be called by such a signifier. And so we must look at this with the understanding and the mandate to approach everything only from the perspective of the authentic self. And that is our responsibility, to live as our authentic self, not as an artificial intelligence that was a self-image or a set of self-images and commands installed in childhood or infancy or even prenatally. So, this Germanic goddess came from an earlier version of the goddess who we know as Ishtar. And there are many myths of Ishtar, but the one I'm interested in mentioning this evening is that at some point she goes into the underworld because her beloved has died and she wants to bring him back to life. And in order to do that, she herself must go through an ordeal. And so for 3 days and nights, she is in the underworld, pinned or crucified to the Eye of God, which is a very interesting symbol. She's in the underworld where the Eye of God reaches, because the Eye of God is all-seeing and is not forbidden or unknown or unseeing of all that occurs even at the darkest levels of the world of shades, shadows. And she is pinned to the Eye of God for 3 days until she is completely absorbed into that power of divine vision. And so her eye becomes the third eye that is the Eye of God. And having that, then she is released from the underworld. When she came down into it, she had to lose everything. But going back up, she is given back her clothes and then her jewelry. And over a period of 7 days, she's given back all of the accoutrement of the goddess, until on the 7th day, she's given her crown. And then she can reestablish the kingdom of the goddess. And she brings back the beloved, who has different names in different versions of the myth. And her own name, because the myth goes back to Sumer and Akkad, becomes Inanna, if we go back even a further several generations back into the Copper Age. But meanwhile, there's also another movement in the ancient Greek world, the goddess of the dawn is Eos, which you can see the relationship And both Ishtar and Eos have a common origin in the Sanskrit goddess of the dawn, Ushas. It's often in the singular Usha, because you can talk about the light of the dawn, or you can talk about the many rays of light that come from the central sun of God consciousness, the Surya. And each of those rays was considered to be a chariot pulling the light, and a different Usha in each one, and they were all both a multiplicity and a unity. And so the goddess of the spring is also the mother of the new world, because she is giving birth to the next cycle of time as the old one dies and comes to an end. Now, if we go back before Easter in the Semitic world, of course, you have Passover or Pesach, which is coming. But we just actually finished another holiday. I should also mention Purim. And why Purim is interesting in terms of this topic of the mystery of evil. The two heroes of this late added Jewish book are a Queen Esther, and her beloved Mordecai. And it was well known throughout history that Esther and Mordecai are also Ishtar and Marduk. Marduk is one of the names of the lover of Ishtar. And in Babylonia, there is the great, it's still there in a great museum, the Gate of Ishtar with the insignia of Marduk on it. And Marduk's insignia is that of a dragon. And we know the dragon has many implications, whether it's the Chinese New Year dragon or the dragons of the Anunnaki and the relation to the Nagas, the gods of the Chthonic world of India, or even related to the alien reptilians that we know so well today. So we have a history of holidays that are all celebrating the same symbolic story of evil and its overcoming. On the Passover plate, there are a number of symbolic food products, we could say, although one of them is not really edible. It's the shank of a lamb, and it signifies, of course, the paschal lamb, the sacrificial lamb. And the Israelites had to smear the blood of that lamb on their door sills, which was the origin of the mezuzah practice. And the angel of death, seeing that blood of the sacrifice, which represented the sacrifice of the ego, of course, the innocent lamb, the angel of death passed over. This is a very important point, because the sacrifice of the innocent is a necessary part of the overcoming of evil, which is quite paradoxical. And yet, if you understand for example, that your own inner child, that is a fragment of your own ego, if you are keeping it alive, then that inner child, having been traumatized and having been born out of the projection of the shadows of the parents, contains the evil. Even though it is innocent, it contains the evil of the parental shadow projections, and in order to be able to tolerate that, had to reproject it internally as superego, demonic superego overlords. And unless we sacrifice the inner child, we cannot be free of the overlords, because once it's sacrificed, they have no one to lord over. And then once the self, the soul, is free from its identification with the child, it is able to return to its uncreated, absolute, almighty power in union with God and annihilate the overlords. And thus, evil is overcome within. Another symbol on the Passover plate is the boiled egg, the cosmic egg. Again, the egg that is a symbol that we see in all of the Western and Eastern traditions, the Hiranyagarbha, the cosmic egg that is refertilized by the union of soul and God, or goddess and God, because the soul is feminine and is a representation of the goddess, a vehicle of the goddess. And this is what enables the rebirth of divine life, in which evil is no more. So the Passover holiday, which of course comes within the frame of reference of a lunar calendar, therefore does not coincide every year with the solar calendar on which Easter is based, is still to come, even though the Last Supper is the prelude to the Easter week crucifixion events, and it is the... the symbolic matrix upon which those events are based. Now, the month that Passover occurs is the month of Nisan. Which is reminiscent of a Hebrew name, Nitzan. Nirji, what does Nitzan mean?
It means a bud of a flower.
That's right, it's a bud. In other words, it's the child form. And if one is named as a child, it almost comes as a kind of command to remain a child. And many of us, whether in the name, because some carry a name that's saddled with an ending of junior, or a name that represents someone else in the past that one's an imitation of, a copy, and one is in a way given the command, especially nowadays when the children are used to support the chakra one needs, often chakra two and chakra three needs of a mother as well. And if one has a mother who is perhaps sexually overstimulating and desirous, she will command that the child, particularly if it's a son, become desirous of her and take on an identity of desire. which will also, of course, bring anger because there is envy of the desired one and a desire to be the one who is desired, which will create some gender confusion. And so the various complications of ego identity, which equally in a girl will turn into fragments of perhaps phallic and vampiric identity in relation to men and envious rivalry with women, etc., etc. So we have a situation where most egos today are given the command, don't grow up, be my eternal child and belong to me and no one else. And at the same time, you must become the one who desires rather than the object of desire who's given the permission to grow beyond the level of child into the ultimate yearning of the soul for God consciousness. And because that has been lost, we have a world of very dysfunctional egos who are often trapped in a state of stunted psycho-spiritual development. How many can relate to that notion? So the overcoming of evil requires the overcoming of the ego and its state of stunted internal development. But the cost of that is the execution, the sacrifice of the inner child, which is the last thing that the consciousness identified with ego wants to do. It's trying to protect the child from traumas and events and situations in which it was threatened with destruction. It had already been sacrificed and defiled by the failure of authentic love in many families. And so the ego is in a conflict between the yearning for freedom from its bondages and the fear of letting go and losing the only aspect of its ego that signifies innocence and goodness. And so again, the mystery of evil is that it is anchored in goodness, which is its defense against its overcoming. And so we have to understand this mystery in order to become free. Human beings suffer from a triple ignorance, all three of which are relevant in the process of psycho-spiritual maturation and development. The first level of ignorance is on the horizontal plane. We are amnesiacs. We are ignorant of the real history of humanity. We are given a false version of history in the dumbed-down educational systems that most of us had to suffer through. And because of that, we believe in false ideals like progress and technology when these are actually instruments of oppression and enslavement, not of liberation. And returning to the understanding of our true history, will require overcoming the second level of ignorance, which is our symbolic ignorance. I would even call it symbolic incompetence. Because we have not been properly educated, we do not know how, most of us, to interpret the symbolic meaning of the mythologies of the world, which are the coded understanding of how to liberate ourselves from the dark forces that oppress us within and without. Now, we've lost the ability through false translations of the sacred scriptures to even understand what their messages are, even if we could interpret them. But the message that we get in whatever language we speak that is current today has a very inaccurate translation of words that no longer, or in effect, were never able to be fully understood in the way that would be necessary in order to extract the wisdom and the power that is contained within the knowledge encoded in those texts. But our symbolic incompetence extends beyond that and makes most of us unable to interpret our own dreams, which are equally messages coming from the superconscious, revealing what's going on in the subconscious. And so overcoming this symbolic ignorance is essential. But none of those two can actually be fully achieved unless we overcome the third ignorance, which is ignorance of our true nature and the true nature of the real. And so it's important not to get lost in the very deep rabbit holes of history and scriptural interpretation and of the various sedimentary levels of the symbolic evolution of the human story, or devolution more accurately. And we can only really heal the wounds that have bound us to body consciousness if we climb to the mountain of God high enough to see the light of dawn while the world of darkness is still in place. And it's that raising of our kundalini altitude that provides the capacity for the internal unification that will free us. So in the kundalini map, we talk about seven chakras. But if we understand them, the first three chakras, that triad of paranoia and security, fear, sexual lust, gratification, desire for possession of the other, and domination, fury, anger, murderous rage, and full tyrannical power over the other, those three elements that have been separated but are all part of a single ego complex in which some are more prone toward one or another of those chakras, those wheels and vortexes of psychological and spiritual energy, all are actually part of a single personifying complex, so that the ego identity will be based on all three. And it's only when the aggression, lust is overcome by wisdom, and desire is overcome by divine love of unconditional and unlimited scope, and the fear, the paranoia, the almost internal dismemberment and chaos within the baby, within the immature consciousness, can only be overcome by entering the void of the absolute absence presence of the Supreme Real. And to get to that, one must reach the first three chakras must unite and then unify the chakra 4, 5, and 6 through the power of self-mastery that chakra 6 represents. And it's only when that power has been retrieved, the power of the goddess, the spanda, the power of the will of God, that produces the beauty that is manifest as the world, as well as ultimately the ugliness produced by the ego's attempt to ravage and control that world. All of that through the power of love of God, of total adoration, will bring all of those energies into their most sublimated and sublated form to unify as chakra 7. And that completes the return journey of Ishtar from the underworld of the ego. And so it is this internal journey of self-transformation, self-upliftment, and finally self-realization that brings about the annihilation of the duality of both good and evil, because God is beyond duality and is inconceivable to the mind of the ego that can only see dualities. So Ishtar, for example, unlike Ishtar and Eos and Ushas, is actually the goddess of both war and love. Interesting both, but it's finite love that she's the goddess of. But as the goddess, she gives birth to those two forces. She is beyond them. And it's the unification of love and war at their finite levels and the transcendence of that power that can split into those two that returns the consciousness to beauty and to truth as a single whole. And so it's not a question, as the 60s posed it, of make love, not war. It's a question of how do we go beyond both finite love and finite war in the final war against the finite self and the victory of the infinite divine self, Jayadev, the victory of God, that returns all to the field of non-duality that is the source of beauty and of supreme, absolute goodness, purity, and bliss that is our true destiny and our origin. So that's the story that we must now make real for ourselves, because it's each of us having that as our individual underlying story in one version or another based on our karma. And it can only be approached when we have overcome the illusion of tragedy. You know, that word is bandied about now, and every time, you know, there's a criminal event or someone dies or becomes sick or loses a loved one, it's called a tragedy. But tragedy is a particular term of art in theater, and it refers to a protagonist who has a tragic flaw. So, for example, Macbeth had a flaw, a chakra 3 flaw. And we could say Hamlet had a chakra 1 flaw. And those tragic flaws became the basis of the plot lines of the drama. We could say that the flaw is evil, but not the drama. Who would say Hamlet's an evil play? Or any of Shakespeare's plays, and yet most of them were about evil characters and evil things happening to good people, but also the overcoming and the context of a world that is not only material but is magical. And to arrive at the level of magic, we must get there through joy, through laughter. And that's why the Gnostic version of Christ is often referred to as the laughing Jesus. In the Synoptic Gospels, he doesn't laugh, but in the Gnostic Gospels, he's almost always laughing. In some versions of the Gospels, you know, I don't know how many of you have read the Nag Hammadi Gospels, that they were banned and a version or a copy of most of them was buried in Egypt in this place called Nag Hammadi, and it was uncovered by accident. And we now have those earliest Gospels of the actual Rav Yeshua. And very interestingly, in some of them, he is above the crucifixion, and what's being crucified is a hologram. And he is laughing because they all think they're crucifying him, but he's free. He doesn't care what they do to his holographic image. But do you all realize that your body is just your holographic image? It's not you, because this is a hologram. And if you realize, then it becomes a hologram. But it's that holiness that comes, and the laughter that can only come when you are so disidentified from the body that you realize you are deathless. And then you become fearless. And then not until you become fearless can there be authentic laughter. And so this is one of the teachings of the authentic Rav Yeshua, who, by the way, during those 18 missing years of his life, went to Kashmir and India and Tibet, and he studied with the sages of the East and brought back wisdom from the East that were part of his teachings. And then there's a story that has a great deal of credibility, that he actually didn't die on the cross at all, that the fix was in. And there was a very wealthy follower who was an Israelite, but was a friend of Pontius Pilate and had a lot of clout because he was a wealthy merchant with ships that brought back riches from various places in the world, including from Albion, from what is now Britain, where he was able to acquire tin that became very useful in the for the military and the Roman legions, etc. So he had a lot of influence, and this man, Joseph of Arimathea, got Yeshua some drugs like morphine that put him out and made him look like he was dead. And he arranged to have him brought off of the cross relatively quickly and put into his own cave, his burial, family burial cave, and then had the best shamans in the land with healing herbs and balms and other ways of reviving Yeshua. And then after 3 days, when he was well enough, he spirited him out of the country, him and Magdalene and their son, and took them by ship to France, where they were deposited in the south of France. He settled there for a while, and they began what became the Order of the Cathars. But then he left because he had to complete his mission by returning to Kashmir, and he returned to study and to complete his ministry in the East. His tomb is still there to be found in Kashmir. It's being cared for well by the Muslims because they also revere him as a great prophet. And what's interesting is the Gnostic Gospels and the Tantric sutras, both the Shaivite and the Buddhist sutras, have parallel, if not identical, statements throughout them, that it's very clear that the same author wrote both. And so I believe that it's quite possible that it's Isa, or Isha, as he was called in the East, was actually the author of such sutras as the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra and even the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. If he didn't write them, he certainly learned them from the sage who did and was able to teach them. So, for example, one of the famous phrases in the Gospel of Thomas is, "The kingdom of God is spread out before you right now, but you do not see it because your third eye is not open." But in the Vimalakirti Sutra that I happen to bring, there's an interesting paragraph. Buddha is talking to Shariputra, one of his disciples, and he says, "Are the sun and the moon not clean when a blind man does not see their cleanliness?" And Shariputra said, "World-honored one, this is the fault of the blind man, not that of the sun and the moon." And the Buddha said, "Shariputra, because of their spiritual blindness, living beings do not see the imposing majesty of the Tathagata's pure land. But this is not the fault of the Buddha. This pure land of mine, this paradise, this Sukhavati, is here now, but you do not see it. You do not recognize the purity of this land, this moment, this instant of now." So the same teaching is there in the East and the West. There aren't different religions. And Isha was taken as a Buddha, for a Buddha, and equivalent to one, and to a great sage and a prophet within the Sufi and Muslim traditions, as well as the Son of God for the Christians. And so the overcoming of evil has to be the overcoming of the two eyes that only see duality and do not see the non-duality that is the perfection of the presence of God pervading all that is. And that can only be seen when you have removed the veils of the ego mind. And those veils are constituted by the constant stream of ego narratives, the constant obscuration of the real by thought constructs that are based on illusory projections. And so to overcome evil, one must overcome one's own mind, one's own egoic stream of consciousness that is limited to reach the unlimited intelligence of the infinite self. And this is what yoga is about and has always been about. To gain the power of silence. It is that silent night, holy night, that we must turn this nightmare of history into, that will bring the new dawn. And so, the resurrection of the soul freed from the ego bondage, prison of thought constructs that create fear and desire and power, lust, can only be overcome through the adoration of the real, the surrender to the real, the sacrifice of the unreal, and the union that brings all partiality to an end in the wholeness of the God Self. This alone is the ultimate purpose of why we have been sent here from the light. This is the moment to fulfill that sacred task that can only be achieved if we are willing to turn our consciousness into an alchemical laboratory that is hermetically sealed so that no ego thoughts can get in until the fire of yoga has burned away all of the latent tendencies, proclivities of the ego to produce more of its delusional thinking. And once that has been completely incinerated, the journey of alchemical resurrection will be complete. And the philosopher's stone, the diamond mind, will be returned to us. May we have the courage, the perseverance, and the grace of God to achieve that goal. Namaste. So, tonight's introduction was a bit longer than perhaps it should have been, so I won't open the floor tonight for questions, but we will have time to talk about all of these matters that have been brought up this evening. and to go more deeply into the nuances of the mysteries of transformation. But this is a retreat in which this must be attained, not just thought about, not just intellectually understood. Let us use this time to create that hermetically sealed vessel and achieve the freedom, the liberation from the ego, back into the God Self through the complete sacrifice of the false self, and to achieve this through a constant, unrelenting vigilance. That remains focused on the presence of God, the presence of the absolute silent awareness, and does not fall back into narratives, for the entire extent of the retreat. And if you do that, you will achieve liberation while alive. So I advise you, do not fall into small talk with each other. Do not socialize from an ego level. If you're going to converse with each other, talk about the teachings. Talk about reaching chakra 7. Talk about the true nature of your being that is the same as the being of everyone. Speak of the wisdom and from the place of divine love and recognition of each other as manifestations of light and of divine power, and encourage each one to abstain from egoic chatter, internal and external, until the silence of the self has been attained in such a sovereignty of internal freedom that no egoic tendencies can return. And if you're willing to do that and to sacrifice the cheap thrill of recounting your egoic narratives to each other, you will gain a great treasure that is infinitely more valuable than such a level of interaction. So I hope that you will take seriously the need for inner stillness and speak only when there is a need in service that you may be doing to know exactly how to proceed or to have some other question answered or to share an insight perhaps, but not to fall into your egoic script, but to completely rip up that script and live free of all past tendencies of the ego to present itself in some definite way, and all of its habits of projection and of attitudinal relationality. And if you live in that internal psycho-spiritual hygiene which is the real meaning of the yogic vow of Shaucha, you will achieve liberation here and now. I wish you all blessings for your God realization.